Welcome to Crime Soup Podcast. I'm your host, Kaylee Carter.
And I'm Hannah.
This week, we'll be deep diving into an open investigation of a woman who has been missing for 25 years. This is the story of Diane Auget. On Wednesday, April 15, 1998, 59-year-old Mildred Young heard her daughter's alarmed and frantic voice over her answering machine. "Help, help, help, let me out," she cried. Mildred was overcome with dread as she listened to the next sounds of the call, the sound of a scuffle as someone was heard trying to take the phone away from her daughter. The last sounds over the voicemail was her daughter demanding to be given the phone again before the call abruptly ended. Diane Auget, born Diane Louise Young, was born on February 21, 1958, to parents James and Mildred Young. She grew up in New York, but relocated with her family to Tampa, Florida. Diane was beautiful. Her sister recalled that she was pretty. There could be 1,000 people in a room, and you'd notice her. In the late 1970s, Diane met and married Frederick Auget, and they had three children, two girls and a boy. Diane was a stay-at-home mom. She took pride in her home and her children. She always made delicious home-cooked meals. The Auget family loved to camp and fish, and by all means, they were a happy, normal family. But their family dynamic started to shift when Diane was diagnosed with manic depression, which we now call bipolar disorder. After her diagnosis, she was prescribed medication that seemed like it helped her more severe symptoms as long as she was taking it. The issue was that Diane only took her medication sporadically. So I looked up what medications were prescribed to patients with bipolar disorder in the late 70s and 80s, and the only medication prescribed was lithium salts, which can have severe side effects. So here are some of like the normal side effects that most people experience on this drug. Diarrhea, a dry mouth or metallic taste in the mouth, feeling thirsty, needing to drink more, and feeling like you have to pee more than usual, slight shaking of the hands, feeling tired or sleepy, weight gain, feeling sick, like feeling nausea. It slows down your thinking and makes you feel more numb. It can cause a loss of appetite and vomiting even. And then some of the more severe side effects of this drug are like problems with your eyesight, feeling really thirsty and having a lack of control over your bodily functions, feeling lightheaded or drowsy, confusion or blackouts, shaking, muscle weakness, muscle twitches, and difficulty speaking. So it's not surprising to me that Diane didn't enjoy taking her medication. Now we have a lot more treatment options available for people with bipolar disorder, but in the 80s, Diane's options were super limited.
This happened after the birth of her third child? Like her bipolar got worse?
Yes. So neurodivergencies are kind of like a special interest of mine. So when I read that Diane had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, I had a lot of questions. Because number one, bipolar disorder isn't usually something that just pops up later in life. Usually it expresses early in life. So there is such a thing as late onset bipolar disorder, but it usually only affects 5 to 10% of people who have it. And usually late onset bipolar disorder doesn't even express in people until they're 50 or 60 years old. And it's usually accompanied like with other medical issues. But Diane was around 28 to 30 years old when she was officially diagnosed. So the reason I think this is relevant is because I think it's possible she had the disorder her entire life and she masked it well for a long time, and that Diane hit a point of burnout, which is common in mood disorders where the person is high masking. But it's also possible, I looked this up, that bipolar disorder can be triggered by postpartum depression or mania. So she had three children, and we don't have like an exact timeline of when her mental illness started becoming unmanageable, but we know for sure that it got really bad after the birth of her third child.
This reminds me of, do you remember when we did our episode on the Kansas City Strangler?
Yeah.
One of the Kansas City Strangler's victims, something very similar, if not this exact same thing, happened to her, where she was married, she had children, she was a stay-at-home mom, and she ended up in homelessness and refused to take any of her medications because she was having those delusions.
Mm-hmm.
She thought that her medications were poisoning her, that they were poison. And that all happened, like that all came to a head right after she had her, specifically her third child.
Yeah. So, like, Andrea Yates, too.
Does she have three kids?
Andrea Yates had, like, five or six kids. And yeah. She got really bad postpartum depression. And what is it? It's postpartum psychosis. She mm-hmm. got really bad postpartum depression at first after her first child. And the doctor was like, please do not have any more children. This is bad. She was severely depressed, having suicidal ideations. But I'm pretty sure they were really religious. And her husband was like, no, you're fine. You can have more kids. So she ended up having like four or five more kids after her first one. And each time her postpartum symptoms got worse and worse and worse until she developed postpartum psychosis and had like delusions of the devil telling her how he was going to hurt her kids. And she came to the conclusion during a psychotic episode that the only way to protect her children from the devil was to kill them. And so she drowned all of her kids in the tub. And it was because of postpartum psychosis. And because her husband was very responsible for this because he kept encouraging her to have children. But she was like a registered nurse, I think.
She was probably, yeah, she was probably very smart.
Like it could happen to anyone.
I knew about Andrea Yates. I didn't know the specifics. I knew that she drowned her kids, but it makes a little bit more sense. And it's really sad in a way that she was doing it in an odd way. From her perspective, she was trying to protect them.
Yeah.
But obviously people don't see it that way. They just hear this woman drowned her kids in the bathtub and they see her as a monster.
Yeah. Like she went to prison, obviously, for what she did. And she got medical help and she was able to alleviate the symptoms of postpartum psychosis. And I don't know if she still suffers from it, but she's a lot better now. And she said a few things about how I think she's just in a better place mentally now and realizes what she's done. She was not herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's actually more common than people realize.
Yes, it absolutely is. In 1988, Child Protective Services opened a child abuse case against Diane, stating that she had opted for excessive, unnecessary medical care for one of her children. We don't have the specifics of what happened, but we know now that this is a mental illness we call Munchausen by proxy. A really famous case surrounding this mental illness is Gypsy Rose's case. So the quick summary of Gypsy Rose's case is that her mother, Dee Dee Blanchard, was convinced that her perfectly healthy daughter was actually deathly ill, and she took her daughter to countless doctors hoping to get invasive and life-altering medical treatment for Gypsy that took her ability to walk, eat, and live a normal life away from her. That case tragically ends with the murder of Dee Dee Blanchard after Gypsy Rose discovered that her mother was the only reason she was ill. And this is a super severe case of Munchausen by proxy.
Can you explain? You glazed over the scariest part of that story, which is she got murdered? What?
Oh, yeah.
What happened?
Basically, Gypsy Rose snuck on the internet. She wasn't allowed to have any type of freedom. Dee Dee was super, super, super militant and totalitarian in their house. So Gypsy snuck and had access to the internet. Ended up meeting this guy online and they were talking and she discovered one day that one of the side effects of the medication that she was on was not being able to walk. And so she stopped taking her medication and discovered that she could walk.
Oh my God.
Which sent her spiraling, obviously. Talked to this guy online, felt super betrayed by her mom, started to figure out what was going on. And then Gypsy and this guy online, I can't even remember his name and I feel bad that I'm not including his name in this. But basically, they planned to kill Gypsy's mom together. So he came over to rescue Gypsy, killed Dee Dee Blanchard, and then took Gypsy with him. And they were on the run for just a couple days before they were caught.
How old was she?
I think she was around 18. I don't think she was a minor at that point anymore.
Okay.
But I could be wrong. I'd have to check.
You just summarized that. You summarized it well, but at the very end, and you're like, and it ends with murder. Moving on. And I was like, what?
Wait a second.
Could you imagine?
Moving on. Yeah, I figured most people would know the case of Gypsy Rose, but
I've never heard that.
It's a really famous case. And they even made like a movie about it, I think, which I've never seen. But yeah, it's a pretty famous story. But that's really funny that you haven't heard of it. Miss True Crime herself. You're not interested in the mainstream stuff. I get it. But yeah, Gypsy Rose's case was a super extreme version of the mental illness that Diane was diagnosed with. So Diane's three children were removed from her care, and Frederick divorced her a few years after and retained full custody of their children. And this caused Diane to mentally spiral, obviously. She began drinking heavily, and she didn't take her medication at all at that point. Mildred, Diane's mother, said that Diane had pictures of her kids on her fridge and that she'd just stare at the pictures and sobbed for hours. Like, she was not well at this point.
I mean, I would do that even as a mentally well person.
Right? Like,
if my, you know, husband took custody of the kids and I just never got to see them, and
yeah,
I would probably just be staring at their pictures and sobbing.
Yeah. So during this period of extra turbulent behavior, Diane was Baker Acted at least 32 times. So the Baker Act is when the state can take you into custody because they think you're ill enough to need a medical exam or medical treatment. And Diane's family said that she would go out on benders where she got really drunk. Drugs were also involved. She'd get picked up by police and either taken to jail or taken into psychiatric care. And she would stay in psychiatric care anywhere from a few days to a few weeks. So 32 times to be Baker Acted is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Diane's brother-in-law, Al Finkenstein, would later recount to reporters in the Tampa area, saying, "She's constantly talking to herself. You can tell right away she's ill." And Diane's own mother would later recall that she hangs out with whoever will be her friend. She's sick. You can't deal with her when she's as manic as she is. She gets in your face and she doesn't shut up. She deeply needed institutionalized care. And I guess I don't know how I feel about those quotes. Like, I...
From her family?
Yeah. Like, I get it.
Well, how do you feel about them? Like, but, you feel like they failed her? Like, they didn't do enough?
No. It honestly sounded like they were doing a lot to try and help her. Like, I think, I'm not 100% sure, from what I read, it sounds like Diane lived with her sister Deborah, and her mother often came to help take care of her, and she was constantly with family, but they were just tired. They were burned out from taking care of her, and she needed a lot of care that they probably couldn't give to her and still work and have families of their own and live normal lives. Like, I'm sure it was really, really hard to care for her, and she needed a lot of help. On the morning of April 10th, 1998, Deborah recalls that she saw Diane for the last time. Later that day, Diane would be seen at the Hay Loft Tavern, located on Little Road and State Road 52. Mildred, Diane's mother, told the Tampa Bay Times that she stayed at the tavern that night until she was kicked out. The bartender cut her off because she started walking in circles. That bartender was the last reported person to see her alive, except for the person who took her. Diane's family reported her missing the next day, on April 11th, but they weren't seriously concerned about her disappearance at this point because Diane had been known to go on benders and disappear for a day or two. Diane's family became worried when Mildred heard the voicemail left by her daughter. This is so weird to me. Did Mildred delete the voicemail? Like, when you listen to a landline voicemail, it tells you the day and the exact time the voicemail was left. So either the police didn't document it and then couldn't remember the exact date, but then why couldn't they just double check with Mildred? Did she not know the exact date? Did they realize they didn't have that info until like weeks, months, years later? And by that time, Mildred had deleted it or didn't remember. It's just really weird that they don't know the exact date the voicemail was left, because it seems like that'd be a really important piece of the puzzle here. And also, it feels like that other people would recognize the relevance of the specific date that the voicemail was left. Don't you think?
That'd be like one of the key pieces of information you would want.
Right?
Like, a woman leaves a disturbing voicemail. She sounds like she's distressed and she's with someone who's taking her phone away. That's the most important piece of information, is when did this happen?
Yeah. I can't wrap my head around how we don't know the exact day and time that the voicemail was left. So obviously Mildred was seriously concerned for her daughter's safety after listening to the voicemail. So she called the number that her daughter called from, and the caller ID showed up as Starlight. Mildred called back many times, but they all went unanswered. So for anybody who doesn't have a landline and who's never used one. When a caller ID name on the screen comes up when you return a call, that indicates that you're calling a business. So there actually used to be a strip club called Starlight Lounge during the time that Diane went missing, but it's now called Teasers. And there's no police info that indicates it's relevant to the case at all, but if I was on the case, it would definitely be relevant to me. I couldn't find anything to say if detectives went to this club or not to corroborate if Diane was even there that night. All we know from reports is that the last place she was seen was the tavern. 5 days after Diane went missing, a human finger was discovered on Route 19 by New York Avenue. The woman who originally saw it thought it was a prop or toy, and she told her boyfriend about it who wanted to see it. He found it and discovered that the finger, painted with red fingernail polish, was actually real. He called the Pasco County Sheriff's Office and they arrived shortly after to document it. Police ran the print of the lone finger through their database and confirmed that the finger belonged to Diane Auget. She had been arrested many times over the past few years, so they had her prints on file.
Okay, I don't know if you know the answer, but this particular area, Route 19 by New York Avenue, is this an urban area? Is this rural? Is this... Were the people who found her finger on a sidewalk?
It was a highway, so it wasn't rural, but it wasn't populated like suburban area, as far as I can tell from the reports anyway. There might have been houses around, but there weren't a ton of businesses around. But people walked along this route to get into town. The sheriff's office organized a ground and helicopter search surrounding the area where Diane's finger was found, but nothing came of the search. Hoping for the best, they also staked out Diane's home and local regular places, hoping that she would turn up, but she never did.
So, okay, I'm sorry, but can we speculate just for a second? Because
absolutely.
This is a weird part of the story.
Yes.
Why do you think... Where did this finger come from? Why is she missing a finger? Is that a normal thing for kidnappers to cut off people's fingers?
Nobody fucking knows. Everyone was just absolutely dumbfounded by this. And it's actually... So another finger was reported to have been seen in the area with the same exact fingernail polish, but they never could find the second finger.
So they're cutting off multiple fingers?
It is suspected, but no one ever found the second finger. One finger was for sure found. There was a second finger reported, but it was never found.
Yeah, and it might have just been people... I don't know.
It could have been not a thing. There could have just been one finger. Somebody was just mistaken or something. But
I'm just trying to think, in what situation would a kidnapper, what motive does someone have to cut your fingers off?
So police were originally hopeful that Diane's finger was severed from an accidental incident. Like whoever took her slammed her finger in the car door and it fell off. But in reality, they thought Diane's situation was a bit more sinister just because of the nature of the finger.
Would that even cause your finger to fall off?
I feel like if it would, it would be really terrible looking. And the woman who first saw the finger thought that it was a toy.
Because it was so well preserved.
Yeah.
It was so fresh looking.
Yeah. So I'm sure it probably more looked like it had been sliced than hammered off with a car door.
Okay, but let's think about this for a second. What kind of tool would it take to get a finger off? Because I honestly don't know. Can you just do that with a pocket knife? Or do you need, a saw?
Number one, humans' mouths are strong enough to bite a finger off. You can bite it off like a carrot. It's really not that hard.
No!
I'm dead ass serious. You could chomp your finger down and bite it right off if you wanted to.
But there's bone in there.
Yeah.
Does it just break at the joint?
You're a predator, Hannah. It was above the second knuckle is where her finger was sliced. So it's possible that it was at a joint.
Oh, so just the first half.
Yeah.
So it's just the tip of her finger, kind of.
But honestly, pruners, pruning cutters?
Yeah, shears.
Shears, yeah. Those could slice off your finger, no big deal.
I'm just trying to figure out what the purpose of that is. Were they torturing her? Maybe they were trying to mutilate her body so that when people found her body, there wouldn't be any fingerprints. But the opposite happened. They specifically found just her finger with her identifying information.
Yeah. Nobody really understands that. I really cannot make sense of it. I really cannot. Diane's poor mother, when she spoke to the Tampa Bay Times, was absolutely distraught because she was like, are they chopping up my daughter piece by piece? Is that what they did to her?
And throwing it out the window or throwing it out the side of the road?
Yeah, and they were in Florida, so did they feed her to alligators? I don't even know.
My immediate suspicion whenever there's body parts thrown out of cars or found on the side of the road is that it might be a truck driver or someone who travels. I don't know, but that's just based on... nothing.
just based on nothing.
Just my intuition that truckers are creepy, that's it. Well, and also, like, not just nothing, because also she was a vagrant, right? Like, she was homeless, not homeless, but she would travel around for days by herself, and she walked by herself at night, and she was along, it sounds like, highways, which is just, I mean, that's...
You're not far off, because, so, her family said, so Diane didn't have a car, and she regularly hitchhiked or relied on new people she had just met for rides. And her family described her as hanging out with a really tough crowd. So you are very possible it could have been somebody, a random person on the highway who picked her up, right? Like, it's absolutely mind-blowing that they just found a lone finger. Mildred Young, Diane's mother, reported that she's hoping for the best outcome, but expecting the worst, in a quote saying, "She is in trouble, big trouble. They're probably torturing her. I'm hoping that she's still alive, that they haven't killed her yet." On April 18th, 7 days after Diane was reported missing, Patricia Splendorio, a convenience store owner, discovered a pile of neatly folded clothes in her outdoor freezer. The story of Diane's disappearance had started to gain media attention, and people in the surrounding area knew about Diane's disappearance. After inspecting the clothes, Patricia believed that they were Diane's. Patricia knew Diane and her family, so she reached out to Deborah, Diane's sister, who confirmed that they were hers. This convenience store was in Odessa, Florida, which is about 22 miles away from Tampa, where Diane went missing. Okay, so a couple questions. What is an outdoor freezer? Because the first thing that I think of is like an ice freezer at like a gas station. And I tried to look it up, but it just showed me like ice freezers.
No, I don't think it's talking about that. It's so the same way that you would have a walk-in fridge or freezer in like a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably where they're keeping food that needs to be preserved for the convenience store. Like, it's extra storage.
Then why wouldn't it be locked?
Because it's the 1990s. So, it's a convenience store. I mean, in my mind, if they're constantly going in and out of it, they would just keep it unlocked, or they're just banking on like who's gonna come in here and steal stuff.
That's weird to me. I've never seen that before, so crazy.
So I was thinking about this case as I was falling asleep last night, and something that made the most sense to me about why Diane's neatly folded clothes would be in this outdoor freezer is that we know that she traveled a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like she had certain places that she hung out, and that this particular convenience store was a place that she frequented, and the owner knew her.
Yeah.
I think what makes the most sense of why her clothes would be in that freezer is that she knew the owner, she knew the location, she was familiar with it. She probably knew that they kept this freezer unlocked, and she just used it as a stashing place to hide clothes so that if she needed any, she could just go and grab them. This reminds me of, like, have you ever been to an amusement park and they make you pay for a locker?
Yeah.
But instead of paying for the locker, you just stash your stuff somewhere and then you go and find it. You like hide it in a potted plant or something.
Yeah.
That's what I think maybe she was doing, is she probably had little nest eggs of things like clothes, maybe toothpaste, feminine hygiene products or something. Just things that it was like her hobo bindle.
Yeah.
And maybe as she was out and she was, you know, roaming around, she had certain places where she knew she could stop and like get a fresh pair of underwear or something. I don't know.
That's actually super, super good theory. Because at this point, the only theory police had about Diane's clothes being in the freezer was that some kids who Diane was hanging out with in the weeks before her disappearance had put the clothes there, which doesn't make any logical sense. But I really like that theory that you have. I think that's smart. I guess my other question then is, so Patricia called Deborah and not the police initially, which is funny to me, I guess.
Well, did she know that there was anything malicious happening?
I guess not. I guess all they knew was that Diane was missing.
Did she know about the finger?
I think so, because Diane's story was getting a lot of media attention, and I think it was because of the finger.
She might be more like me, which is that before calling the police, I have to make sure I'm not overreacting and run it past someone first. Because that's how I am. Other people, they're like, no, this is weird. You're like this. You're like, this is weird. I'm calling the police. Me, I'm like, I feel crazy. So I'm going to talk to someone and make sure I'm not overreacting first. And then I'm going to call the police.
And that's exactly what Patricia did.
That's my best guess, is she was just like,
Yeah.
Because it's not like she found a bloody knife or something. She just found some clothes.
Yeah, that's true. So, like I said, the only theory about Diane's clothes the police had was that some kids had put them there. And apparently the kids that Diane had been hanging out with had been looting Diane's home starting around the time she went missing. She had been known to invite the kids over and even let them throw parties at her house when she was gone. And I have no details about how old these kids were or if they were ever looked into for Diane's disappearance.
This is actually kind of sad. I mean, the whole story is sad, but at first I was like, why is she having these random kids over to throw parties? And then I realized it's probably because she misses her own kids and is trying to fill that void in her life of trying to have people around her, because she probably spent a decent amount of time alone, feeling like an outcast. People probably weren't always super keen on talking to her. Like, even her own mother said that Diane was obviously unwell, and so people probably avoided her.
Yeah. Like, how isolating that would be to go from having your perfect little family with your little babies and your extended family that you got along with to a life of complete isolation. And there's a quote later down in the story that Diane's mother said that Diane would just be friends with anyone who would talk to her. Like, she just was so lonely. Continuing on about the clothes in the freezer, there was no timeline for when the clothes had been placed in the freezer. The store employees hadn't checked the freezer for 3 weeks before Diane's disappearance, so there was no way of realistically knowing when the clothes had even been put there. Yet again, another huge piece of evidence that wasn't actually helpful at all. All of the questions about the case kept piling up, except a witness reported that they had seen Diane walking along New York Avenue, the place where the finger was found, on April 11th sometime between 3 and 4 p.m. So this would be crazy, because the woman who originally found Diane's finger said she saw it at 4 p.m. while walking on New York Avenue on her way to work, the same day the witness saw Diane walking.
So, like, it would have happened, like, right around the same time.
Yes, if the witness statement is correct, that means Diane's finger had been freshly cut off, which is probably why the woman who discovered it thought it was a prop. It probably looked pristine at that point, because it had only been sitting
there. Where did the rest of her body go?
Exactly. Nobody knows. Another witness came forward, a waitress for an establishment called the Gulf and Hudson, claimed to have seen Diane at the bar or at the Gulf and Hudson on the same day she made her ominous voicemail to her mother. But again, we don't know exactly what day she even made the phone call. So no one was able to corroborate the waitress's witness statement, so we don't know for sure if she was even at the Gulf and Hudson on the day she left the voicemail. Diane's case went cold very quickly after her disappearance, and she was ruled a missing person. In November of 2000, 2 years after her disappearance, Diane's parents spoke to some local news organizations about their daughter, hoping to reignite the case and that the public might be able to fill in some details. So the reason that the Pasco County Sheriff's Office gave for keeping Diane's case open is that they just had so much evidence for this case. They just needed a direction to run in, and they didn't have it. On November 25th, 2000, one day after the Tampa Bay Times published Diane's article, another bizarre piece of evidence was discovered that would baffle investigators and Diane's family. Terry Wilson, Diane's brother's girlfriend, was at a Circle K convenience store along Highway 19, just north of Hudson in a neighborhood that Diane had been known to frequent, when her eye caught a plastic bag on top of the lottery counter with Diane's name written in black Sharpie. Intrigued, Terry took the bag back to her boyfriend's family, who opened it and discovered a handful of things that appeared to be Diane's. Again, this is 2 years after Diane went missing. All of the contents of the bag were things Diane used at the time of her disappearance. This included black eyeliner, Taboo perfume, bright pink lipstick, and a generic brand of toothpaste. This stuff is all pretty generic, and it could be coincidental, but the thing that stood out to Diane's family and investigators is that this brand of toothpaste was the same tube that the mental health facilities gave to outbound patients. And we know that Diane had just been released from a mental health facility days before she vanished. Police looked at the Circle K security footage, but nothing was found. Again, another dead end from a huge piece of evidence. But investigators now believe that either Diane or someone who knew what happened to Diane was still in the area. Okay, do you think that whoever killed Diane read the Tampa Bay Times article, realized they still had some of Diane's stuff, and then, like, abandoned it?
I would have assumed that if it was someone with a guilty conscience, that they would try and destroy her belongings. Instead of, like, neatly leave it in a public place with her, like, specifically her name on it.
Yeah, that's the weirdest part, that her name was on it.
Because it sounds like it's not malicious.
Like, why wouldn't they just throw it away? And destroy the bag somewhere. I have no idea. It made no sense to anybody. Everybody was super weirded out, obviously. At 4 a.m. on Wednesday, June 27th, 2001, two masked men attempted to rob the Coral Sands Motel in Hudson, Florida. They barged into the hotel office, which was a trailer that owners Gary Evers and Rose Casper also lived in. Rose was working the front desk that night, and the two men confronted her with firearms. The men ended up hitting Rose several times before Gary Evers, who was in the back of the trailer, was able to chase the men off. The Coral Sands was a cheap motel off Highway 19 for people with nowhere else to go. Gary Evers had suspicions about who the masked gunmen were, specifically 26-year-old Todd Cammers, who had a long history of burglary and other petty crimes in the area. Gary asked Todd to come to the Coral Sands Motel on June 28th, the day after the attempted burglary. Todd obliged and came to reason with Gary Evers, but when Todd arrived, Gary became agitated, believing that he was confronting the man that assaulted his girlfriend, and Gary pulled out a 9mm pistol and emptied two whole magazines into Todd's body. Gary Evers was arrested for first-degree murder on June 29th, the morning after he murdered Todd, but it was later discovered that Todd wasn't even responsible for the motel burglary. Todd only went to the motel to clear his name. The true culprits were a pair of men who had committed a string of robberies earlier that same week.
I'm sorry, but the very specific part where you said that he emptied two whole magazines into Todd's body, that means that he had to empty the clip, take it out, put another one in, and keep shooting.
Yep.
What? One clip is enough to kill someone.
Yes, and I specifically put that in there because I think it's a testament to how violent this man is.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Overkill.
Overkill, exactly.
Like, maybe he would snip some fingers off.
Exactly. The reason this is relevant? According to police, Gary Evers was the primary suspect in Diane Augett's disappearance. Gary actually didn't have a criminal history prior to Todd Kamer's murder. However, there was a situation where police were dispatched to the motel because Gary pulled a gun on a man for attempting to sleep with a stripper who had a boyfriend, but no charges were ever filed.
What?
It turns out that police knew that the Coral Sands Motel was one of Diane's last known locations before her disappearance, but this wasn't widely known. The motel was only a short distance away from where her finger was found, and it was also close to the Circle K where the bag of her belongings was found. Investigators never released exactly why he was the main suspect or whether or not he was ever confronted or questioned about Diane's disappearance, and I guess we'll never know for sure since he passed away serving his life sentence for killing Todd in 2012. But I did want to talk about the weird similarities that we can pull from what we know about this case, because I don't think police release everything, but from what we do know. Gary pulled a gun on a man for attempting to sleep with a stripper, so it's probably safe to assume that he knew about the Starlight Lounge strip club and potentially even went there. Diane just kind of roamed around, so it's very possible that she was there as well. Diane would take rides, basically get into the car with anybody, and Gary had a quiet place to essentially hurt Diane at the hotel, the motel that he owned, right? I don't know. We don't have any type of motive or anything, but it feels like there's a lot of things pointing to Gary now that we know this.
So let me get this. I want to make sure that I'm getting the timeline right. So okay. Correct me. So what we know of her movements around the time that she disappeared, she was last seen on the 11th walking on the side of the highway where her finger was found about 3 to 4 p.m.
Yeah.
And then we don't know when the voicemail was placed, but sometime after that, it sounds like she placed a voicemail to her mother and we can hear someone trying to take the phone away from her. And the Star 69 said that it was most likely the Starlight Lounge, which is a strip club.
Yeah.
But we don't know when the voicemail, is it possible that the voicemail was placed before she was seen on the highway?
The voicemail came after she had already been reported missing.
After her finger was missing.
Yes.
Okay. So we can assume that it sounds like somebody picked her up off the side of the road. Somehow she loses a finger and she gets taken to a strip club.
I have no idea. And then police somehow figure out that she was at the Coral Sands Motel at some point during that time, too.
Oh, hold on. Something's coming into sight. Maybe the bag of her clothes, lipstick, eyeliner. Is it possible that she was working as a stripper and those were her clothes that she kept in a locker at the strip club?
You know, that is something. We know for sure that Diane didn't have a job. At least
not a job that she told people
exactly,
about.
Exactly. Not a documented job. But it is very possible that she could have been working at the Starlight Lounge.
Because somehow she has to be paying for her room at the motel.
Unless Gary took her there.
Yeah.
Or Gary asked for favors in exchange for a room.
Exactly, yeah. So how she was paying or favoring people in order to get a room, we don't know. But I think that's my biggest theory, is that maybe she's tied to the strip club in some way. My best guess is, since she is young and attractive and she is in a desperate situation, it makes sense that she maybe was picking up work there. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense that eyeliner and lipstick and clothes would be there. And maybe the owners of the strip club or somebody tied to the strip club, when they found out that she had died or gone missing, were like, I don't want any of her stuff here. I don't want them coming and checking us out, because they might be doing other shady stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also possible that she was working as a sex worker, maybe at the Starlight Lounge.
And I mean, it's not entirely unheard of for people to exploit mentally ill women.
Exactly.
And putting them in these positions where they're having to sell their bodies just to make ends meet and be able to have a bed at night.
Yeah.
I don't feel like there's enough evidence to point us in any really particular direction with Diane's case. Like,
yeah, we don't even know if she's dead. Diane Auget was 40 years old when she went missing in 1998. She has blue eyes and dark blonde hair. At the time of her disappearance, she was 5 feet 4 inches tall and weighed 130 pounds. She was last seen wearing blue shorts, a white tank top, and white sneakers. If you have any information about Diane, please contact the Pasco County Sheriff's Office at 800-854-2862. Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Crime Suit Podcast. Be sure to find us on social media and let us know your thoughts on this case. You can find us on TikTok at Crime Suit Podcast and on Instagram and Twitter at crime_soup. We also have a website, crimesuitpodcast.com, where you can listen to all of our episodes and buy your very own Crime Suit merch. As always, we'll see you next Tuesday. Stay safe and bon appetit.